loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we examine the United Nations Climate Change Report. It's a dire and urgent warning. We talk about it as Hurricane Michael hits land in the Florida panhandle. And then it's Wednesday, so we continue our regular segment called Beyond Nuclear, where we look at nuclear issues, including nuclear weapons, nuclear energy, waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, major media outlets lined up today to praise the tenure of Nikki Haley as U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. The Washington Post said she succeeded in promoting multilateralism for a president who opposes multilateralism. The New York Times said Haley, quote, would be missed, unquote, and lauded her pragmatism and positive relationships with other diplomats. An Israeli diplomat lamented that, quote, now Israel has only one ambassador to the United Nations. Next, Turkish authorities investigating the disappearance of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi said today that the well-known writer appears to have entered the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, where he was killed on the orders of the Saudi leadership and dismembered by four men who subsequently left from the back of the building, drove to the airport, and flew to Saudi Arabia. Meanwhile, condemnation of Khashoggi's apparent murder is rippling across the globe. Then, Israeli authorities have detained an American graduate student at the airport in Tel Aviv for the past week solely because she is a supporter of the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, or BDS, movement. Laura Al-Qassam, whose grandparents are Palestinian, has a valid Israeli visa, but she will be deported because of her political views. She's being confined while she appeals the decision. And then, nearly 2 years ago, Marcus Mitchell and many other indigenous activists stood up to the oil and gas corporations trying to build the Dakota Access Pipeline through their land. While protesting to protect his land, Marcus was blinded in one eye and lost partial hearing in one ear due to a lead pellet shot directly at his head by a county sheriff. Yet now he's facing 2 years in prison. And finally, Google announced that it would drop out of a bid for a $10 billion cloud contract with the Defense Department, saying that the project conflicted with its corporate values. In the meantime, the company announced that it would create a search engine for use only in China that would make it impossible to use certain search terms. And the company is appealing a 5 billion euro fine for running a monopoly in Europe. And in other headlines, Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen and FBI Director Christopher Wray testified today to the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee about President Trump's claim that China has been influencing U.S. elections. Wray stated, quote, China in many ways represents the broadest, most complicated, most long-term counterintelligence threat we face, unquote. This comes on the heels of a major speech by Vice President Mike Pence at the Hudson Institute, where he attacked China on a range of issues. Former Guatemalan Vice President Roxana Baldetti has been sentenced to 15 years in prison for corruption. Baldetti was the deputy to disgraced ex-president Otto Perez Molina, who held office from 2012 to 2015. The scandal during Perez and Baldetti's administration ignited a mass movement in the country, with huge demonstrations forcing the creation of an independent international commission against impunity in Guatemala that has cracked down on corruption. Turkey has announced that rebel forces in the Syrian province of Idlib have completed their withdrawal of heavy weapons from a designated buffer zone between opposition fighters and the government. The buffer zone and the withdrawal of heavy weaponry was agreed to last month in the Russian city of Sochi. The agreement averted a major military offensive to retake the province. Amazon has announced that it will stop using a tool it built to assess applications from potential employees. The tool worked by storing data derived from the resumes of people who worked in the tech industry, who are primarily men. Amazon has now realized that the tool has a strong bias against women applicants, including grading resumes lower for even having the word women on the page. For instance, in the case of Captain of Women's Chess Team or Women's College. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and clear.
Now we turn to Hurricane Michael. An enormous Category 4 hurricane is tearing into the Florida panhandle and many people have been unable to evacuate. Extreme weather events just keep getting worse, and scientists agree climate change is the culprit. A new report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has an ominous warning for everybody in the world. The anticipated 1.5 degrees Celsius temperature rise we should expect to see in the next 12 years will be far worse than the 1 degree rise we've already seen. Report was written by 132 authors drawing on 6,000 peer-reviewed studies, and its findings are grim. If we don't curb the emissions of greenhouse gases immediately, people will die. Species will become extinct, the food supply will dwindle, and ocean levels will rise precipitously. The following interview was recorded today, October 10th at 12 noon. We're joined from Tallahassee, Florida, in the middle of the Hurricane Michael by Shelby Shoup. She is a student activist at Florida State University. We're joined from Burlington, Vermont by Fred Magdoff. Fred is a professor emeritus of plant and soil science at the University of Vermont and the co-author of What Every Environmentalist Needs to Know About Capitalism and, quote, Creating an Ecological Society Towards a Revolutionary Transformation, both from Monthly Review Press. And we're joined from Geneva, New York by Jody Dean. She is a professor of political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges, and her latest book is Crowds and Party. Welcome to the three of you.
Hi, thank you.
Good to be here.
Thank you so much.
Shelby Shoup, you are a student at Florida State University. You are in Tallahassee. We want to start in the first couple minutes just to have a report from you. What is it like? Has the main force of the storm arrived? What's going on?
So the main force hasn't arrived yet. The storm is really, the brunt of it is supposed to hit in the next 2 or 3 hours. But the chaos has definitely already started. The last 3 days here in Tallahassee has been just absolutely frantic. People crossing the state line to get gas, like my coworker. People scrambling to get to Walmart, Uber surges as people are trying to evacuate or get where they need to be for supplies. Car crashes from the frenzied scavenge for survival.
Yeah. And what will you do?
I'm staying here. Staying at a friend's place. We have a room in this apartment complex that, there's no windows. We've got water. I got some buckets from the restaurant I work at to fill with water. But mostly we're just hunkering down. I felt like I couldn't leave partially because I don't have a car and I can't afford a car and I couldn't afford transportation. And also because I want to be here immediately afterwards because I'm coordinating with some folks around the state. From the Panhandle all the way down to Miami to start getting some storm relief, some mutual aid as soon as we can. So I wanted to be here on the ground.
Yeah, Shelby Shoup is one of our guests. Shelby, before we let you go, I want to just make the point. You know, we've interviewed people in Cuba because Cuba, of course, is in the path of many hurricanes, as is Florida, as is the southern part of the United States. As the hurricane approaches, every person in Cuba, every single person knows exactly where they're going. They know how they're going to get there. They know if they're a grandparent, where their grandchildren will be and how the grandchild is going to get there. Like, society is completely mobilized to handle this. And here you are in Florida, not a developing country, not a country that, not a place that has suffered from the legacy of colonialism, but people are forced to resort to individual forms of salvation. And if you don't have a car, you can't evacuate. If you're really, really poor, and let's say you have a mom or a dad who's at home or bedridden, you can't leave. It's every person for themselves. Go ahead.
Exactly right. It's every person for themselves. Under our capitalist, infrastructure, or rather lack of infrastructure for storms, everyone has to fend for themselves and fight each other for water and for gas and for shelter. There's only 5 official shelters, maybe 6 in Tallahassee that I know of, where people could evacuate to if they couldn't leave town. And of course, that only considers people who are not incarcerated. The Florida Department of Corrections, there are 15 prisons in the mandatory evacuation zone. From what I understand, 6 of them have been evacuated. And this is unconfirmed. I heard that from someone I know who has a loved one in prison. Oh, our power just went out actually just now. But exactly, it's a mad dash. It's an individualistic dash for survival instead of living in a socialist, structure where they have, a government-issued evacuation plan, like in China, like in Cuba, where these massive storms only see, they'll see less than 10 people die because people are prepared, because they know that they're supposed to be working together for their survival instead of fighting for themselves.
Yeah, that was Shelby Shoup. We're going to let Shelby go. She's in Tallahassee. The storm, the heart of the storm is about to crash into Tallahassee, into the panhandle. We wish you the very best. I know you have to kind of get ready for that. Shelby Shoup, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank y'all for having me.
Very best of luck down there.
Yes.
Appreciate it. All right. I'm going to go before my power really gets out. See y'all.
Okay. Bye-bye. Fred Magdoff, this comes just on the heels of this UN climate report. You can see that the scientists who authored this report, and it's based on 6,000 peer-reviewed studies, they wrote it with extreme urgency. They're trying to sort of ring the bell here. 12 years is the amount of time they give the world to reduce carbon emissions drastically enough so that the temperatures don't increase beyond what they're suggesting in some ways will be a tipping point. Anyway, how'd you read the report?
They have certainly assembled the best information that's available, and the picture does not look good. They've written the report with a tremendous sense of urgency, although they left out some, there was some editing of the report not to make it too disturbing for certain people. But they basically CO2 emissions need to be reduced by something like 45% by 2030, and then by 2050, there should be a zero rate of increase of CO2 in the atmosphere. In other words, not any more going in than going out. So that's for 1.5, and I think the main point of this report is that 1.5 degrees centigrade is bad, very bad, but it's a lot better than 2 degrees centigrade. But even getting to 1.5 and stopping at 1.5 will take a monumental effort. I think those are really the two main points of the report.
Jody Dean, a monumental effort is what's required. It's a vast challenge because it's not just a matter of human beings making rational decisions. There's institutions of political and economic power that are going in the absolute different direction. I want to read the first couple sentences to you from a New York Times article about the report and then have you comment. A landmark report from the United Nations Scientific Panel on Climate Change paints a far more dire picture of the immediate consequences of climate change than previously thought, and says that avoiding the damage required transforming the world economy at a speed and a scale that has, quote, no documented historic precedent. So in the best imaginable circumstances, to do what needs to be done requires doing something that has no precedent in human history in terms of a shift, a change, a transformation. Wow. I mean, you can't get more alarming. Go ahead.
It's as if the New York Times is calling for a revolution. So if I know that might sound really dramatic, but let's think about it. For the kind of transformation necessary, for that to happen, we have to have global cooperation. We have to have the strongest countries that have that are the highest emitters of carbon. We have to have them agree to transform completely their economies and to work together to mitigate the effects on the majority of the world's population. So I don't see any other word for that other than revolution, right? It means that we have to, that we can't go on in the way that we've been going on. It can't be the case that we have major international conflicts and where, let's say, countries like the United States refuse to go along with the Paris Climate Agreement. We can't continue in a militaristic, imperialistic direction. And we can't continue with a capitalist economy that relies on fossil fuels. So it seems to me that what we're getting from the reasonable, the rational, reasonable response is that if we are going trying to keep the emissions at a low enough level to avoid going above 1.5 degrees centigrade, we have to do something utterly dramatic that's never been done before. And I don't know any other word for that than revolution, I have to say. I mean, that might seem dramatic, but I don't know another word. And I want to say one more thing. The IPCC report says that we have 12 years to do this. Right, we have 12 years to change things. We might be able to think of 12 years gradually, but in the grand scheme of things, considering it has never been done, and to reorient economies as large as the United States, right, means getting rid of capitalist incentives, getting rid of a fossil fuel infrastructure, changing everything in order to have a habitable planet. That's what's called for.
Fred Magdoff, I'm wondering if this is so much more than just coal. I mean, much of the report focused on coal, but how much is also dependent on our use of oil and oil products, or the manufacturing of downstream products and chemicals? And how much of this is our fault, I guess, is really what I want to ask. Is this largely an American problem, or does a lot of this come from Chinese economic development or Indian economic development? Where does the fault lie?
Well, historically, the United States has produced the most, you know, carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, with carbon dioxide being the major one. Right now, China is producing more CO2 than the United States is, but don't forget that some of that is to produce products that are being shipped over to the United States. So it really should be on our part of the scorecard, if you will. But it is not also an issue of countries. I think it's really important to keep in mind that this is basically an issue of very wealthy people on a global scale living much higher than they really can be living if we're going to keep within our carbon budget. And some 50% of the emissions of CO2 goes to keep up the lifestyle for the top 10% of the world. And about 70% of the CO2 that's produced is to go to keep the lifestyle of the richest 20%. That's not just the 1%, okay? So we're talking about quite a few people, but they're still a vast minority of the world's population. Is their consumption habits and what they're doing is creating a very large percentage of the problem. So it's not just an issue of reorienting economies, which is absolutely true, and we need to have an economic system in which you can make rational decisions based on what people need, what the environment needs, what other species need. And there's no way to do that within a capitalist society, that because the decisions made by individual companies are being made on the basis of profits, and the governments are in place and kept in place by people who basically by very powerful economic forces that want to keep it going more or less the same way. So they don't want a drastic change. They might be agreeable to minor changes, like Exxon is talking about. Maybe we should have a carbon tax, and they're willing to put $1 million, which is nothing for them, right? I mean, it's like you saying, "Oh, I'm willing to put 5 cents towards that."
1 cent.
1 cent. Okay. I mean, it doesn't affect anything. They're trying to give some lip service. I don't know if this report is what caused that to happen or not. But this is of huge magnitude. I don't see any way that it can be done. Certainly not the 1.5 degree. Trying to keep within 1.5 degrees can be done within the system that has a certain logic and a certain way of operating. You know, if we just keep going the way we're going right now, basically, what the scientists were saying, we're talking about 3 or 4 degrees centigrade increase in temperature, way above the disaster of 1.5 and the much greater disaster of 2 degrees centigrade.
That's the voice of Fred Magdoff. He's a professor emeritus of plant and soil science at the University of Vermont. He's the co-author of several books, including What Every Environmentalist Needs to Know About Capitalism and Creating an Ecological Society Towards a Revolutionary Transformation, and both are published by Monthly Review Press. We're also joined from Geneva, New York, by Jody Dean. Jody is a professor of political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. Her latest book is Crowds and Party. Jody, let's go back to the concept of a revolution, or, and as Fred's book calls it, a revolutionary transformation. Revolutions only happen from time to time. There needs to be a certain set of conditions that allow the existing system to be toppled and replaced by a new system. I'm not certain. I feel pretty confident that those circumstances don't exist at the moment, even though I agree with the idea and believe that people should be working in the direction of a revolutionary transformation. But let's just assume for a moment, this is a question for both of you. Let's assume for a moment that there could be a revolution and that all of the impediments, the obstacles, the institutions of economic and political power, the state institutions that stand in the way of making rational decisions about how the economy could be organized so as to prevent further carbon emissions, basically, to keep the carbon in the ground. That's essentially what the scientists are telling us with great urgency. Keep the carbon in the ground. Do the technologies exist, and can the instruments be made available that would allow for not the revolution, but the revolutionary transformation of how economies use energy? Go ahead, Jody, and then Fred Magdoff, same question.
Yes. So the first answer is yes. And let me go back to the IPCC report. What that report makes clear is that with respect to science and technology, there is definitely right now an existing capacity to keep the temperature increase at 1.5 degrees. That capacity exists, right? And the report is very clear as well that there are multiple paths. There's all sorts of different ways to get there with respect to where are cuts made, what kinds of technologies are implemented, what sort of changes are made. There's different ways. It doesn't all have to be one thing. The only thing that stands in the way of actually keeping the temperature rise within the 1.5 degrees centigrade limit is political, right? It's a matter of political will. It's the contemporary economic and political system that we have that's the block. So with respect to technology and with respect to science, it's utterly possible. And that's one of the things that makes this both urgent and possible and potentially tragic all at once, because we have a means of stopping it. There's actually something even a little bit upbeat about this dire report, even though that seems paradoxical, because it makes it clear that, hey, people, you all have the capacity to do this if you're able to organize yourselves enough to make it happen.
Fred Magdoff, same question.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, this is, I put it maybe slightly differently, but it's basically the same answer, that the technologies exist. What we need to do, we know. I mean, what needs to be done in terms of cuts and ways of organizing things. So the option is there to do it. The problem is, the political system is tied in with the economic system. So we have an economic system which basically very wealthy people control what happens. This is in most of the advanced countries of the world and most of the so-called developing countries of the world. And these decisions are being based on what they think is good for them. It has nothing to do with what's good for the vast majority of people, let alone, you know, the planet and the other species that are out there that we want to live and to thrive. So this is the good side is, yes, we know how to do it. The bad side is they're very powerful, the overwhelming difficulty is that the economic and political power is held in very tightly by people who don't want to change.
Jody Dean, Donald Trump says the environment's fabulous. He likes it.
You know, one of the things that's interesting about that claim is it made me start thinking about Florida and his property at Mar-a-Lago. And, you know, I wonder, do they not face flooding? Or is it the case that the super rich are able to avoid the you know, having to be impacted by the Uber surges, by the struggle to survive, by the frantic struggle to get water or buy bottled water at Walmart or Costco, by all of the things that Shelby Shoup described that she was facing today in Tallahassee, right? Like, she couldn't leave because she doesn't have a car and transportation's really expensive. So I think that, yeah, maybe there might be parts of the climate change that the super rich can weather that they're not worried about because they don't face the struggle to survive. It also reminds us that it's the poorer parts of the world that aren't right now bearing the impact of climate change that we already feel and that will continue to bear that impact. So in some ways, the kind of grab for wealth that we've seen the super rich really intensify over the last 10 years, we could also see as maybe symptomatic of climate change because they're taking everything that they can so that they can weather the storm, that while the rest of us end up in droughts, end up in floods, end up in situations of wildfires and forest fires, and end up having to migrate or in conditions of widespread civil war over resources. So I think that one of the reasons that he might say it's fabulous is because his class are the people who don't have to worry about it.
Yeah. And Fred, that's part of the same point that you are making. It's not just about what nations do. It's the class structure in society. I'm looking at Science Magazine, by the way. The headline is Cuba embarks on a 100-year plan to protect itself from climate change. But these are all of these mechanisms, because Cuba's an island, a small country. It doesn't have the capacity to really impact on what the world is using for oil, using for energy. Is it using oil? Is it using coal? It can take protective measures, but really, bottom line, we have to change and we have to be free to change where we get energy from. That's the bottom line, right?
Well, yeah, we have to do that. We have to use also the other bottom line is that we need a restructuring of society so that there is, it's more egalitarian, and you don't have these extremely wealthy people wasting an incredible amount of energy on all their toys, their yachts and their jet planes and their 17 houses or however many they have all over the world. And, I mean, it's an obscene misuse of resources. And it's, as I mentioned earlier, you know, it's the wealthy people of the world, some of them extremely wealthy, some not so wealthy, but pretty well off, that are causing a very high percentage of the emissions of greenhouse gases.
Yeah. And Jody, in our last minute, the same could be said for the U.S. military. I mean, I think it's the largest consumer of energy products, oil and gas products, again, just to maintain this empire. It's not about keeping the country safe. If you really want to keep Americans safe, you do something about climate change. Why don't you take us out? We have 45 seconds left.
Absolutely. One of the costs of imperialism is the effects on the climate. I mean, we usually think about imperialism as killing people directly through guns and bombs, but it's also killing the planet indirectly, killing multiple species by contributing to widespread warming and climate change. So U.S. imperialism has a cost, and it's paid for by more than the U.S. taxpayer, by more than the people we attack. It's paid for by the entire planet.
All right. That was the voice of Jody Dean. Jody joined us from Geneva, New York. She is a professor of political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. Her latest book is Crowds and Party. We were also joined from Vermont by Fred Magdoff. He's a professor emeritus of plant and soil science at the University of Vermont, the co-author of several books, including What Every Environmentalist Needs to Know About Capitalism and Creating an Ecological Society Towards a Revolutionary Transformation, both published by Monthly Review Press. Earlier, we were joined by Shelby Shoup. She is a student activist at Florida State University. We talked to her from Tallahassee, where the storm is about to hit with full force. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. It's Wednesday, so we continue our regular segment called Beyond Nuclear, where we take a look at nuclear issues, including nuclear weapons, nuclear energy, nuclear waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States. We are joined every week by Kevin Camps, usually in Washington, D.C., frequently in our studio. But Kevin this week is in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Kevin is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear, and you can read his writings and find out about the group and how you can get involved with Beyond Nuclear by going to their website, beyondnuclear.org. And we are joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Nicole Roussel. Nicole, it's been seconds since I've seen you.
That's true.
Welcome back.
Well, thank you so much. I'm honored to be here.
But it's been a week, Kevin, since we've seen you. Why are you in Michigan?
Oh, I'm in between work travel and my mom needs to get to Florida, so I'm helping her with that.
Florida is not the destination
not a good place right now.
We've had to delay because of the hurricane.
I'm sure.
Yeah, we talked to a young FSU, Florida State University student in Tallahassee earlier today. I mean, it's really amazing. And you, Kevin, have helped us understand and helped our audience understand that not only do we face, we, the human race, the human family, face all of these incredible hardships when these extreme weather events happen, but also because of nuclear technology and its proximity to places where hurricanes hit or where volcanoes happen or where earthquakes happen, the danger isn't just in the days and the weeks after the storm. It could be potentially life-changing for us, for the human species. Any dangers that you are aware of in that regard regarding this Hurricane Michael?
I was checking out the maps of reactor locations down there, and sure enough, there's a nuclear power plant called Farley in Alabama, not too far north of Destin, Florida. So out of the storm surge danger, of course, because that's just a coastal impact, but the high winds and the potential for flooding. Again, you lose the primary grid and you lose the emergency diesels and you're in a Fukushima-like situation. So, yeah, hold your breath at times like this.
Hurricane Michael is expecting extremely heavy rains. So despite, like you said, it's not in the storm surge, but I mean, very, very heavy rains are also incredibly problematic, right, Kevin?
Well, all the reactors are on surface cooling water supplies. So I think in the case of Sarley Nuclear Power Plant that it's a river or a lake. And the flooding potential, there's so many weak links in safety and cooling systems at nuclear plants. So for one example, if the cooling water pumps associated with the emergency diesels were to be submerged underwater, it renders them dysfunctional. That's what happened, actually, at Fukushima Daiichi because of the tsunami that hit. So any flood can take out, you know, the last line of defense at a nuclear power plant. So these are all the risks that have to be dodged with this ever intensifying extreme weather that we face in the realm of nuclear power.
Yeah, we'll keep following that. Of course, you know, the people in the area have been so hard hit, and of course these other looming huge disasters, hopefully they won't happen. Kevin Camps, let's turn to another story. We were intrigued, Nicole and I were, when we saw this article in Sputnik News website. The title is Russian Scientists Discover Bacteria That Neutralizes Nuclear Waste. I'm going to read a couple sentences to you and then get your comments. The unique bacteria discovered in a nuclear waste storage site in Siberia shows promise as a tool for the creation of a natural barrier to the spread of radionuclides. Researchers from the Moscow-based Frumkin Institute of Physical Chemistry and the Russian Academy of Sciences Federal Research Center for Biotechnology have been able to isolate microorganisms which can be used to safeguard the surrounding environment from liquid radioactive waste. Scientists made the discovery while conducting microbiological studies of the groundwater at the Siversky Deep Radiation Burial Site in the Tomsk region of Siberia, where liquid radioactive waste from the Siberian Chemical Combine, which supplies and reprocesses low-enriched uranium for nuclear fuel, is stored. And the research was recently published in a magazine called Radioactive Waste, a Russian scientific journal. And it suggests that the bacteria is capable of converting radionuclide ions, including those found in uranium and plutonium, into sedentary forms, thereby preventing the spread of dangerous radiation into the surrounding environment. Anyway, Kevin Camps, what do you make of this story?
Well, I did read the article, but I've not had a chance to read the scientific study behind it. And I just have to express some skepticism. For one thing, we hear about these magical solutions to the radioactive waste problem from time to time, and they often always turn out to be false answers. In this particular case, there have been claims in the past about bacteria or other microbes able to help with the radioactive waste problem. But the thing is, you know, bacteria and other microbes can chemically transform substances, and so perhaps that's what they're getting at here. One thing they can't do, though, is they can't magically, alchemically change the physics of radioactive nuclei. So those are some of the questions that are begged. Another one that came to mind immediately is, why are they burying liquid high-level radioactive waste? Shouldn't they be solidifying it first to stabilize it? So there's a lot of questions. I do look forward to reading that article. I'll just point out that, you know, sometimes bacteria and microbes are problematic when it comes to radioactive waste. So, for example, at the proposed Yucca Mountain dump in Nevada, incredibly, microbes are going to accelerate the deterioration and degradation of the waste burial containers because of the environmental conditions inside the mountain. So, and I, you know, more facetiously here, but, you know, radioactively mutated bacteria. I mean, more seriously, radioactivity does cause mutation. So we're mutating life forms, even at the microbial level, which, you know, in my book, isn't really a good thing.
Yeah, definitely. It is interesting. I do wonder in the study if they kind of talk a little bit more about some of the, you know, potential side problems, side effects that could be happening here. But I think what's notable about what you just said, Kevin, is all of these sorts of magic solutions kind of constantly are coming up and mostly they don't actually work. I find that really interesting because clearly it's such a huge problem that people are looking for these magic solutions, but we just don't. It's just very dangerous and there just haven't been magic solutions yet.
It's ironic that this good news supposedly is coming out of Tomsk in Russia, which is one of the worst radioactively contaminated places on Earth because of the nefarious nuclear weapons activities that have taken place there. So one thing.
Just a follow-up question on that. You said it's odd that there would be the burying of liquid radioactive waste instead of solidifying it. Is that a common practice in Russia or elsewhere?
It used to be more common when there was no environmental concern whatsoever that liquid high-level radioactive waste, all that much more mobile in the environment, was simply either, you know, discharged into surface waters like the Tuka River in Siberia with huge health consequences for residents downstream, or injected into pits and groundwater, like has happened even in the United States. But for many decades now, there's been a realization that you just can't do that. You've got to at least solidify it. And even that has proved daunting at places like Hanford, Washington. They've had real problems trying to glassify the liquid high-level radioactive wastes. And so as we wait for years and decades for them to get the glassification to work, leaks keep happening at Hanford, into soil, into groundwater, right on the edge of the Columbia River. So when it's liquid, it's even more risky.
So, Kevin, let's move on to another story. We had Brett Kavanaugh recently get both nominated and confirmed, sworn into the Supreme Court. There's been a lot of analysis of his, well, there's been a lot of analysis of a lot of the things he's done in his life. But one thing I think that didn't get a lot of press was a lot of his rulings, especially on the environment. But I know you've been looking into some of his work and some of his judicial rulings on the environment. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, the one that sticks in my craw the worst was a 2016 ruling by Kavanaugh, and he was not alone, unfortunately, on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. It was in Nuclear Waste Confidence, and we had sued against the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for their carte blanche permission to allow nuclear power plants to make as much high-level radioactive waste as they want. Don't worry about it. I'm sure it'll all work out. And, of course, that's absurd. And unfortunately, the court and Kavanaugh did give a green light to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, to the nuclear power industry, to just go ahead and keep on making it, even though we have no solutions. And an interesting case that just got ruled on by the Richmond, Virginia Federal Appeals Court yesterday looks like the final stake in the heart of the vampire called the MOX fuel fabrication facility we've talked about in the past. It's this white elephant, this boondoggle, $5 billion of federal taxpayer money wasted in South Carolina, and the state of South Carolina is trying to keep the project on life support just to keep raking in the dough from the federal treasury. And this appeals court in Virginia has now said, nope, the Department of Energy has every right to cancel this disaster, this fiasco. And you have to wonder if South Carolina, in its stubbornness, might not just appeal to a higher level. That would be the U.S. Supreme Court, upon which now Kavanaugh sits.
That's not great. That's not great news at all.
Kavanaugh has been groomed for a long time by the Federalist Society, this group of legal, I don't want to use the word scholars, but, you know, self-described scholars, to be what they want him to be and what they want the judiciary to be, which is completely opposed to any kind of regulations on any kind of business, but including nuclear power. I mean, this is the position of these so-called lawyers and legal scholars who are really just at the service of the same powerful economic interests, Kevin Kamps, that you have been telling us are what's really driving the continuation and the bailout of this failed industry, which not only is bankrupt in many places, but also posing existential threats. I mean, the nuclear energy industry and the right-wing political apparatus and machine, this has always been a sort of a cardinal issue for them.
Well, you know what's funny? It's not funny. It's ironic about the Federalist Society, the Heritage Foundation, other, you know, supposedly fiscally conservative institutions and organizations. They seem to do a carve-out for nuclear power, I guess because there's so much money to be made. But in this particular case, I mentioned the boondoggle, the white elephant, $5 billion of American taxpayer money absolutely wasted with nothing to show for it. $5 billion with a B. And incredibly enough, South Carolina, which would like to claim to be fiscally conservative, is just fine with this wastage. And another layer of irony in the MOX fuel fabrication facility is that even in the cancellation of the so-called swords into plowshares, taking military-grade, weapons-usable plutonium excess to military needs and turning it into reactor fuel, a very bad idea from the start, guess what their plan B is? They want to now convert the site to nuclear weapons pit production out of plutonium. So no longer is it swords into plowshares, it's now plowshares into swords. So they're just making it up as they go and raking in the dough as they go along.
Can you talk a little bit more about that? So can you just remind the audience what the mixed uranium plutonium oxide, the MOX project, is, what it was, why you all are opposed to it, and again, what's kind of going to happen moving forward?
Yeah, so the big picture problem is that the U.S. military, in its rambunction, created tens of tons of plutonium excess to their needs in the nuclear weapons arsenal. They can't even use it. They have too much. They're awash in it. And so the U.S. and Russia signed a treaty for dealing with all this excess military plutonium in both countries. And unfortunately, against our protests, they decided they were going to turn it into reactor fuel, which is risky to use in reactors. It increases the risk of an accident. It increases the consequences of an accident. Plutonium is ultra hazardous. And it also creates the need for a police state because you got to guard the stuff 24/7, 365 at a place like a nuclear reactor on the roads to transport it around. And so after all these years, 11 years of construction on the MOX fuel fabrication facility, they finally admitted that it's been a complete waste of $5 billion. Because the facility was built too small for the equipment needed to do this procedure in the first place. Whoops, you know, they've just screwed up left and right. It's been a huge boon to, you know, the companies involved. They've pocketed that money. But incredibly enough, it's such a fiasco. It would cost $17 billion to complete. It wouldn't be complete until 2048. But even the Trump Department of Energy has decided to pull the plug on the project, you know, to their credit. And the state of South Carolina tried to say, no, we have commitments here. You have to keep paying us $300 million plus per year for this boondoggle. And finally, the courts have agreed at a higher level that, no, the Department of Energy has the right to cancel a project when it's a complete fiscal disaster and engineering disaster, and that's where we're at now. The question is, will South Carolina appeal to the Supreme Court? I don't think they will. Their language in the last round was that if, you know, the courts allow cancellation, then that's it. It's irreversible, and hopefully it is.
So it sounds like this was a project that just never made any sense. It was kind of a workaround for extra plutonium we had. We tried to make it into fuel. It's not normally fuel, and we've spent just a ton of money, and it's been a huge waste of time and money, and now we're finally shutting it down, but there's still a fight going on.
Yeah, we had called way back in the 1990s for the plutonium to be mixed back in with the high-level radioactive waste from which it came, made back into a deadly waste, forever deadly, and then dealt with, which means deep geologic disposal, if you can find geology that will scientifically isolate it from the living environment and a site that's environmentally just and consent-based, and the list goes on. Of course, we don't have that site, but that's what we proposed more than 20 years ago. And they're just getting back to, what are we going to do with this stuff? So we would stick by our old proposal.
Gotcha. And also, to turn back to the Supreme Court's kind of place in all of this, do you happen to know how the last nominee, Merrick Garland, would have stood on something like this? Did he have any opinions that were relevant?
Well, he did issue a good ruling. He was in the dissent, though. It was a 2-1 loss for our side on the Yucca Mountain, Nevada proposal. Again, the state of South Carolina, Aiken County, South Carolina, were involved in this case on the wrong side, trying to stick the high-level radioactive waste from the commercial industry in this country down Nevada's throat against its will at a scientifically unsuitable site that happens to belong to the Western Shoshone Indians by treaty, Yucca Mountain. And Merrick Garland ruled that it's a bad idea to keep spending money on this licensing proceeding because there's no more money behind it. And you get a little bit ways down the road on the licensing proceeding and you're completely out of money. And why did you waste that money to just hit the dead end? And two Republican appointees said, no, we want the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to spend every cent they have left. And they have. They are now out of money. And until Congress and the White House appropriate more money for the Yucca Mountain licensing proceeding, it is just stuck. It is stopped. And we like that. And we wish they would just be done with the Yucca Mountain fiasco. But of course, especially House Republicans are keeping on pushing it. So we're still fighting that one, too. But Garland voted the right way on that ruling. That was in 2013.
Nicole, I'm glad you mentioned Merrick Garland. He had been, as just to remind people, Obama's pick for the Supreme Court seat that eventually went to arch-conservative Gorsuch. Now, Merrick Garland was basically the Senate Republicans just absolutely refused for the last year of the Obama administration to allow that nominee to go forward. It's interesting to remember that. Merrick Garland was on the Court of Appeals with Brett Kavanaugh. He's not a liberal. He's a center or center-right winger. And, you know, what's interesting about it, when you think, and I wanted to go back to the Federalist Society and the grooming of Brett Kavanaugh, Merrick Garland, according to a recent report, voted 93% of the time with Brett Kavanaugh while they were both on the D.C. Court of Appeals. In the D.C. Court of Appeals, the circuit, the Court of Appeals here in the District of Columbia is considered perhaps the most premier Court of Appeals in the country and frequently a stepping stone to the Supreme Court. So they voted together 93% of the time. That means they share a lot in common. But, you know, Kevin's description of how Garland voted or in dissent on the Yucca Mountain is an indication that Merrick Garland, while basically pretty conservative, is not 100% reliable for business interests, which is why the Federalist Society, I think, has groomed Kavanaugh, because Kavanaugh is 100%. He's not one of these Supreme Court justices who's going to morph to the center or morph to the left, which historically, when you look at the Supreme Court, those kind of things happened. A lifetime appointment, they had political freedom to move. There was a lot of moving towards the direction of the center if they were from the right or even into the liberal camp for some conservative justices. The Federalist Society, Kevin, just doesn't want to take any chances. So they have guys like Kavanaugh, who's really just a political hack. I mean, he will never, ever diverge. I mean, short of sort of like multitudes of revolutionary people surrounding the Supreme Court or perhaps his home in Bethesda. Anyway, That's what the big business interests, Kevin, they don't want anybody to go off script even one little bit.
And what's interesting right now in my life is we are fighting some major legal battles, for example, in Texas and New Mexico against these centralized interim storage facilities for highly radioactive irradiated nuclear fuel because Yucca is effectively stuck and canceled unless they resurrect it. And these battles are raging. And where do they go? You know, it may take years to get there, but, you know, whichever side loses, if they've got the resources, for our side, that's a real challenge, but it could end up in the Supreme Court. You know, it's the last stop on these legal fights. And we're in the midst of it now. We just got Holtec International in New Mexico and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission staff, both proponents of this centralized interim storage facility, just came back at us just last night with their filings, which are voluminous and daunting. And we have one whole week to reply to them. And at the same time, simultaneously, we are fighting a similar dump in Texas. And so we will do our best to stop these dumps in the legal arena, but that could well mean going to federal court, and whoever loses will appeal it, and we'll see where this ends up.
Another case of these huge law firms having, you know, a dozen people working on this, just drowning you all in paperwork. And, you know, how big is Beyond Nuclear? There's five people, six people?
No, don't. They have thousands, we don't want to reveal their strength at this moment.
They're very strong. They've got a ton of people on their side. And speaking of that,
have truth on their side.
They also have truth on their side.
And they have justice on their side.
Great. All great points.
Well, you know, the good thing in this fight is it's not just Beyond Nuclear, although we do have really good legal representation. Diane Curran of Washington, D.C., and Mindy Goldstein of Turner Environmental Law Clinic at Emory University in Atlanta, and her students who are a part of the legal counsel for us. But in addition to Beyond Nuclear's effort, we've also got a really broad coalition. We have one environmental coalition that's coast to coast, represented by Terry Lodge of Toledo, Ohio, who's been on your show last May. And Alliance for Environmental Strategies is the local New Mexico grassroots group. So that's just kind of the tip of our iceberg. I mean, we are fighting this legal fight, but we have people in the streets. We have municipal resolutions being passed in New Mexico and Texas, and hopefully beyond, as people wake up to the fact that the radioactive waste trucks and trains and barges would pass through their communities in most states. So we're bringing it at them, and this legal fight is just one aspect of our resistance.
You know, I'm glad we're talking about this kind of David and Goliath fight, because in a way, if you look at it just as like a staid, passive mathematical equation, all the money is on one side. With that money, they can hire all these powerful corporate lawyers. They can get all these politicians into their back pocket. On our side, on the people's side, the resources seem, you know, very small in comparison. And yet every time real social change happens against seemingly omnipotent power, it's because this other element enters into the historical equation, which is average, so-called, ordinary, so-called people, we the people, become activated, become conscious, become interventionist. We become actors on the historical stage. And in fact, when you have the people, there's, you know, it's kind of a cliche, but it's true. There is no power greater. And I think that's why this segment is important. I think that's why Kevin's work and the work of BeyondNuclear.org and the other anti-nuclear activists is so important, because we can actually bring about change. And the thing is, we can't bring about change unless people are mobilizing, agitating, educating, in other words, struggling. That's the key thing. And that's what Kevin Camps and Beyond Nuclear represent. That's why I just want to urge people who are listening to this maybe for the first time or the second time, get involved. Don't just listen. Become a player. Become an actor. Get involved. And you can do so by going to beyondnuclear.org.
I think you can also submit public comments to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission about these very interim storage facility battles that are happening, and, you know, which, as Kevin would launch, you know, these huge number of shipments of radioactive waste, probably by near you. I mean, they're going all across the country. So these are incredibly dangerous. If they're not coming near you, they're coming near your family members. And it's not an appropriate, you know, use of our rails. It's not an appropriate use of our roads. we have other ways to produce energy for this country. So, Kevin, would you tell our audience how people might submit those public comments?
Yeah, and actually I'll do a post at the very top of our homepage, which is www.beyondnuclear.org. We have until October 19th for the public to submit comments to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, in this particular case about the waste control specialist's proposed dump site in West Texas. Numbers matter, but so does quality, and we have sample comments prepared and instructions on how to submit them, and I will put that at the top of our homepage.
Let me just ask you about this, because we're working also, Kevin, we in the Answer Coalition with the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund and a large coalition of forces that's trying to stop the Trump administration's use of the National Park Service to introduce new regulations on permitting and protests in Washington, D.C. that will eventually eliminate protests as we know it in Washington, D.C., if it were to succeed. And the comment period is very brief, even though it's a hugely important, dramatic, new set of regulations. The deadline is, I think, October 15th, so people had very limited time. But the point that the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund is making to people is that it's important to make a comment about why this is bad for you, why it impacts you, because the government agency, whatever the government agency is, they have to respond to each and every comment. And those comments thus become part of the public record. And if there's litigation that comes afterwards, it's based on the existing public record. So what people say and do, how they comment, it actually can make a big difference, right?
Yeah, in a sense, it's like demonstrating in the streets. When you file a comment, your comment is registered as a part of the official record, strength in numbers. We have shut down some bad nuclear projects just with overwhelming public comments. Sometimes it takes more than that. They keep stubbornly pushing forward, and we have to take it to court or take it to the streets. But we take these public comment proceedings very seriously, and we try to show up as best we can every time.
Kevin, there's another really interesting piece that you sent around earlier today that I thought I really wanted to talk about. So it's about Illinois, which received a $2.35 billion nuclear bailout. And I just would love for you to talk through the results of that analysis, which I think will be surprising for people.
Well, when they sold this idea that if the public, in this case Illinois ratepayers on their electric bills, were to bail out Exelon Nuclear, an already filthy rich nuclear utility with the most reactors of any in the country, that somehow it would, you know, benefit them on their electric bills. Somehow the rates would be reduced by this action. And in fact, the opposite has happened in the last couple years since the bailout went into place. And it turns out that Illinois' electricity is artificially expensive. And it's because Exelon Nuclear, thanks so much for the bailout, is just a real monopolistic force in especially northern Illinois, Chicago. And so the grid operator, PJM, Pennsylvania, Jersey, Maryland, that stretches all the way to northern Illinois from the Atlantic, has just kind of admitted, you know, that, well, you know, prices are pretty elevated in Illinois. We're going to have to figure out what to do about this. But in the meantime, Exelon is you know, laughing all the way to the bank with this huge bailout. And we've seen a similar bailout in New York State. There are other ones proposed in places like Pennsylvania and Ohio. And boy, it seems like the nuclear industry and its lobbyists get what they want every single time, and the public, not so much.
And this is for just a very basic need for electricity to just run the basic things in your own home. It's really absolutely something.
One of the real downsides of all this is that these subsidies keeping the nukes alive and the coal, it blocks renewables from coming in. So as countries like Germany enter the 21st century of electricity, we're stuck in the 20th and even 19th century.
All right, we're going to leave it there. That was Kevin Camps. He is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. As we said earlier, go to the website beyondnuclear.org, get involved. We've also been joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Nicole Roussel. This segment, Beyond Nuclear, happens every Wednesday right here on Loud and Clear. Stay with us. We're taking a short break, but we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.